Hi, good morning. It's wonderful to see you all here. And I'd like to mention also that KUNM Albuquerque is here, as well as KRZA and Alamosa Taos, two community-based radio stations. Where, unlike many of their brethren on the East Coast, particularly in the Boston-Miami corridor, you can hear the likes of Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky and Barbara Ehrenreich and other radical voices that are pretty much not permitted to have access to what is ostensibly our public airwaves. I want to do something a little different in terms of introducing Howard Zinn. You can find out all of the bibliographical information, date of birth, where he went to school, and you know his experience in World War II in our book and in other books as well. So let me just start then with a Sufi teaching story. The Sufism is the esoteric inner dimension of Islam. A religion that is, of course, much maligned and distorted today. It is virtually an official enemy. And the great Sufi teacher and poet wrote in Persian in the 13th century is Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi, or just known as Rumi. And one of his wonderful stories is called The Elephant in the Dark. And let me see if I can make this connection with this presentation. The Elephant in the Dark is about a group of people who are assembled and are blindfolded, and they are asked to touch different parts of the elephant and to identify what they perceive. So one person steps forward and grabs the tail and says, "Oh, it's a rope." Another person comes forward and touches the ear and says it's a fan. A third comes forward and touches the leg and says it's a pillar. And in each way, the perceptors only perceive part of the whole. They never realize the larger picture. Now, and I think what Howard Zinn has done and is doing in his writing of history is presenting the parts, all of the parts, so that we can perceive what has been occluded. Much of what is called history is largely manufactured, constructed. It is a series of highly selective events. People's history is occluded, distorted, or completely omitted. And for years, the story of Columbus is a good example, and I grew up with that in New York City. Here, you know, Columbus Day, this wonderful navigator, this brave and fearless admiral who crossed the seas with the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. I mean, this was like catechism for us. And, you know, but somewhere buried in the text was something about Taino and Arawak Indians. Oh. Well, who were they, and what were they doing there, and what happened to them? Well, if you read the conventional classic account by Samuel Eliot Morison, you find out that Columbus committed genocide, was responsible for a genocidal campaign in all the Caribbean islands that he and his men visited. And this, in Morison's history, is like an anecdotal aside. The main thing is what a brave man he was and how much we owe him and the fearless navigator and that kind of stuff. So I think in Howard Zinn's brilliant first chapter of a people's history of the United States, all of a sudden the complete picture of the elephant, if you will, is revealed. The true nature of Columbus and his arrival as seen from those who were affected by it. So this is history from the grassroots up, not from the top down, which is the traditional, conventional way of presenting history. History as seen through the eyes of the Taino and Arawak Indians. And how has culture changed? Culture has changed dramatically. In 1992, and I think Howard Zinn has been very influential in the changing of our consciousness and in cultural perceptions. In 1992, in Denver, there was going to be the 500th anniversary of Columbus's arrival. Well, on that day, there was such an enormous turnout of protesters. There were more protesters and demonstrators in Denver than actual parade participants that the organizers of the parade decided to cancel the event. Now this, 20, 30 years ago, would have been unthinkable. But it's precisely because of the work of Howard Zinn and the People's History of the United States and this commitment to stripping off the layers of deceit and the webs of deception that have so enshrouded history and the distortion of the past, that such an evolution, a remarkable change has occurred. Howard's very good friend and comrade is Noam Chomsky, and in 1967 he wrote a book called The Responsibility of Intellectuals, and in that book, in that essay, Chomsky wrote that it is the responsibility of intellectuals to speak the truth and expose lies. And I think Howard Zinn, through his work and through his practice, and this is what makes him a bit of a Sufi, because it's not just preaching, but it's also his actual work, his willingness to go to Everett, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston, and be in solidarity with striking Salvadoran immigrant women who are trying to organize a union in, and they're working under horrendous sweatshop conditions. So being out there with people in solidarity and kind of that IWW slogan of an injury to one is an injury to all, also really epitomizes Howard's wonderful blend of not just scholarship, but activism. So you have this intersection of scholarship in service of the people, rather than some obscure goal and clouded in jargon and that appear in journals that only other academics can read. But this is actually history you can use. And there are many things to tell about Howard, but something I'd like you to know is, so I get a chance to travel around the country a lot and meet with people, is the enormous amount of affection and care that he generates. Wherever I go and Howard's name comes up, people say, "I love this man," or "he changed my life," or "when I read this book, it launched me on a new career path." So that's the other dimension of Howard, that, and it'll soon become apparent to you that I wanted you to know that he is held, and if I can say it, I know it's not fashionable on the left or progressives to emote or show emotion, but because we're cool and we're right, correct. So so we don't want to get into mushy stuff, but sometimes it's very appropriate, and I love this man dearly, and many others do as well. And please join me in welcoming Howard Zinn to the Taos Talking Film Festival. Howard!
Who is that man? never been introduced with Sufi philosophy. I've always cherished this moment, David. And, I'm proud to be introduced by David Barsamian. How shall I describe him? Well, I'll introduce now David Barsamian. We'll go back and forth. I guess he's the I.F. Stone of broadcasting. And for those of you who don't know who I.F. Stone is, I can tell you that I.F. Stone is the David Barsamian of newspaper journalism. So, thanks, David, for those modest words. Somebody gave me something to announce. I always announce things that people give me if I like them. And this says emergency mobilization to stop the war. And there's going to be a great gathering, a national march on the Pentagon on June 5th. I hope you'll think about that and maybe think about joining it. When I began reading history and studying history and teaching history and writing history, I kept coming across incidents and events and people that led me to think, because I always loved the movies, however hateful they may have been sometimes, but I always loved the movies, and when I would read about things in history, I would always think, wow, what a movie this would make. And then I would look for it. And it wasn't there. And it took me a while to realize that Hollywood isn't going to make movies like the ones that I'm thinking about. Hollywood isn't going to make movies that have the effect of making people more class conscious or more anti-war or more conscious of the need for racial equality and sexual equality. No, they're not going to make movies like this. And I wondered about this, and it seemed to me there was not really an accident. I mean, you could say, well, it's just an oversight on the part of Hollywood that they have not made a film about the Ludlow Massacre in Colorado. Just an accident, like the accidents that you hear about on television now. If you turn on the television, as I turned on this morning, they were explaining the accident that happened, you know, where NATO forces bombed this column of refugees from Kosovo. And these things are always accidents. Now you might say, well, they're not really deliberate. They didn't really mean to do this. But they're not accidents. That is, nobody got together in a room. The people in Hollywood didn't get together in a room and decide, we're going to just do this kind of film and not the other kind of film. And nobody in NATO headquarters or in the United States government had to get together and say, are we going to bomb civilians? They don't have to do that, and yet it's not an accident. There was somebody at one point who used the expression to describe events which are not accidents, not planned deliberately, but are something in between. He called it the natural selection of accidents, where if there's a certain structure to a situation, then these things will inevitably happen, whether anybody plans them or not. And so the structure of war is such that innocent people are going to get killed. I heard President Clinton, I know it's surprising to you to hear a political harangue, and I will maybe talk about other things, except that behind these other things, there will always be a political harangue, you see. But I heard President Clinton, you know, talk about, well, we didn't mean this, but civilian casualties are inevitable when you carry on war. Well, he was absolutely right, which then leads you to two conclusions. Either you just have to accept civilian casualties, or you have to do away with war, you see. And that's, you know, but, you know, the second is unthinkable. Yeah. And so it's the structure of war is such, and the structure of Hollywood is such that it will not produce the kind of films that I imagined when I read history, and when I began to write history. That is a structure, I suppose, which you can describe simply as based on the need to make lots of money, and where money and profit are absolutely the first consideration before art, before aesthetics, before human values. So, when I was invited to this film festival, never been invited to a film festival before, just like I've never been introduced in terms of Sufi philosophy. All sorts of new things are happening to me, you see. Never been invited to a film festival. And so I thought, well, here's my chance, right? Here are filmmakers, and I will tell them about the things that I wanted to see done on film, you see, so that they can all immediately go out and do it.
I'm going to try to give you a little more. There you
are. Thank you. Okay. So I think about making films that will make war abhorrent to people. And when you think about the films that have come out of Hollywood about war, and there have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of films about war, they are almost always films that glorify military heroism and war. I mean, there are occasional departures from that. But mostly it's yes, military heroes, military heroism, and the kind of films that will not persuade young audiences that they should not immediately go to war and embrace war. So I began to think about telling a story of wars from a different perspective. And when you look at war from a different perspective, you come up with all sorts of scenarios. And you take the Revolutionary War, which, well, how can you speak against the Revolutionary War, right? It's one of our good wars. We have lists. We have good wars, bad wars. I had a student once who wrote about war, and she said, you know, wars are like wines. There are good years and bad years. See? She said, but war, she said, is not like wine. She said, war is like cyanide. One drop and you're dead. So even the good wars need to be reexamined and seen as not simply how they're presented to us in such a way as to make war acceptable as a way of solving problems. And so I'll take this one of the best of our wars, which is the Revolutionary War. And if you tell the story of the Revolution not from the standpoint of the founding fathers and not from the standpoint of, yes, the need for... And remember, wars, yes, they're a complex phenomenon and there are moral issues intertwined with them. And the Americans were oppressed by the English, but there were also Americans who were oppressed by Americans. The Revolutionary War was not that simple. And if you, for instance, Indians did not rush in exultation to celebrate the victory of the colonists over England, because for them it meant that the line that the British had set against westward expansion, the proclamation of 1763, that line would now be obliterated, and now the colonists would be free to move west into Indian territory. They were not celebrating the American Revolution. Black slaves were not celebrating the American Revolution. And, you know, it was estimated that maybe one-third of the American colonists supported the American Revolution, and one-third were opposed, and one-third were neutral. This was John Adams, one of the founding fathers and one of the revolutionary leaders. This was his estimate. And so I thought it would be interesting to tell the story of the American Revolution from the standpoint of just an ordinary working man who listens to the Declaration of Independence read to him from the balcony in Boston, promising freedom and equality and so on, and immediately told that rich people can get out of service by paying several hundred dollars. Yeah. But who then, and despite his misgivings and despite his own feeling of being oppressed, not just by the British but by the leaders of the colonial world in which he is having such a hard time surviving with his family, but he joins because he's promised some land and so on. But then he becomes, as the war progresses and he sees the mutilations and the killings, and he sees that the officers of the Revolutionary Army are living in high splendor, and the privates, I mean, there's no place in society where the class divisions are more clear-cut than in the military. And the ordinary enlisted men don't have any clothes and don't have any shoes and aren't being paid and are being fed slop. And so he joins the mutineers. And you know, in the Revolutionary War, there were mutinies against Washington's army. And the mutiny of the Pennsylvania line, the mutiny of the New Jersey line. So I thought it would be interesting to tell a story of a working man who joins the Revolutionary Army and fights in battles and is wounded, but who then joins the Pennsylvania line, and they mutiny, and they march on the Continental Congress, but finally they're surrounded by Washington's army, and several of their comrades are forced to shoot several of the mutineers. And then this soldier, embittered by what he's seen, gets out of the army, gets some land in western Massachusetts, and then becomes a part of the rebellion after the war is over. There is a rebellion in western Massachusetts called Shays' Rebellion, in which small farmers are rebelling against the rich men who control the legislature in Boston, who are imposing heavy taxes on them, taking away their land and their farms. And Shays' Rebellion is a popular rebellion of veterans of the Revolutionary War and other small farmers who surround the courthouses and refuse to let the auctioneer go in there to auction off their farms. And then the militia is called out to suppress them, and then the militia goes over to their side. And until finally an army is raised by the moneyed people in Boston that finally suppresses Shays' Rebellion. But I had never seen that story told. Of course, I was talking to somebody last night who really knows a lot about film, teaches film and so on, and I told him, you know, I think that I'm probably at some point I'm going to say, I'm waiting for a film like this to be made, and then somebody in the audience will say, and probably be you, say, yes, it was made. But I don't think that film that I just described was made. And if I describe a film to you that I think should be made and I think wasn't made, and you know that it was made, I wish you'd let me know so we can have a celebration of that rare event, you see. But that, wars can be told in such a way that complicate the simple good versus evil a scenario that is presented to us in our history books and in our culture, and that make it known that wars are not simply wars of one people or against another, but wars always involve class differences within each side, in which the victory in war is very often a victory that's not shared by everybody. But only shared by a few. and that the people who fight the wars are not the people who benefit from the wars. And then I thought somebody should do something on the Mexican War. I haven't seen anything on the Mexican War that, it, for instance, tells how the war started. It tells about the deception that took place of the American people by the President of the United States. I know it's surprising to hear that an American president would deceive the people of the United States. But this was that one rare case in which the president, President Polk, deceived the people of the United States by telling them, you know, Mexican troops have fired on us on American soil. Well, it wasn't American soil. It was a disputed soil in which both the Mexicans and the Americans claimed, and there was incident and people were killed, and zoom, we were at war. A war that had been planned in advance before this incident by the Polk administration because they coveted this beautiful territory of the Southwest. And I thought it would be interesting to tell that story from the standpoint of of an ordinary soldier in the Mexican War who sees the mayhem and the bloodshed as the army moves into Mexico and destroys town after town in Mexico more and more of these soldiers get disaffected from the war, and as they're moving on the final march under General Scott towards Mexico City, General Scott wakes up one morning and half of his army has deserted. I thought, yes, it'd be interesting to tell it from that point of view. Or to tell it from the point of view of one of the Massachusetts volunteers who comes back at the end of the war and have a celebration, you know, of the victory, this great victory in which half of Mexico has been taken away by the United States. And they have a victory celebration, and the commander of the Massachusetts Volunteers is being honored up at the podium. And as he gets up to speak, he is booed off the platform by the half of the Massachusetts Volunteers who are still alive, and who think about what happened to their comrades in the war, and who look around and wonder what they were fighting for. And there's another sort of scene in that story of the Mexican War, as that scene where the American army is moving to take over the territory seized from Mexico and has moved into this country, into what is now called New Mexico, and moves into Santa Fe and has to suppress a rebellion because these are mostly Mexicans living here, and the United States government is taking it over. And the army marches through the streets of Santa Fe after their military victory, and all the people in Santa Fe get into their houses and close the shutters, and the army is met by total silent resistance, which is an expression of how the population feels about this great victory of the American army. Anyway, I thought it would be useful to look at the Mexican War from a slightly different point of view. And then there's the I guess I thought I'd start off with the issue of war today because we are making war right now. And I've thought about the usual immediate, yes, we support our commander-in-chief and so on, 65%. Of course, I always look at it differently. I say, yes, but 35% don't go along. And since the propaganda machine takes hold of the airwaves, of 98% of the airwaves, to have 35% oppose is a victory and a sign that some people, you know, are thinking. You see, and I think about another little thing I forgot about the Mexican War, which I might make the movie a little more interesting. And that is some of the deserters. And a lot of the people who volunteer in the Mexican War are, they volunteer for the same reason that so many poor working class people volunteer for the military. It's not that they're imbued with the idea of going to war. They're just desperately poor, and they hope that their fortunes will better as a result of the war. And many of these volunteers are recent immigrants, and many of them are Irish immigrants. And a number of these Irish immigrant soldiers, as they watch what is being done to the people of Mexico, desert and go over to the Mexican side. And I don't know how many of you know about it. Maybe in New Mexico people know more about this. In fact, I'm sure people in New Mexico know more about this than people in other parts of the country. But they form their own battalion fighting with the Mexicans, which they call St. Patrick's Battalion, and which becomes the San Patricio Battalion. An amazing event in the Mexican War. I was made to think about that, or reminded of that when because I was about to talk about the war in the Philippines, and right after the Spanish-American War. And then, our history books are full. I haven't even seen much film, and some of you can correct me with this, about the Spanish-American War. I suppose it's hard. No, maybe it's not hard for Hollywood. Hollywood can do anything. But it's not easy to make the Spanish-American War a noble enterprise. I don't think it's gotten a lot of attention in film. In the textbooks, in the history classes, the Spanish-American War, yes, is, it's called a splendid little war. Last 3 months, short, victory over the Spaniards. We did it to free the Cubans, because we're always going to war to free somebody. So we expel the Spaniards from Cuba, but we don't expel ourselves from Cuba. And the United States takes over, in effect, takes over Cuba from that point on. One of the things that we have against Castro is that he broke into that long interrupted control of Cuba by the United States. That's a complicated thing of what's happened in the Cuban Revolution, it's true. But I think it's fair to say that's one grievance that the United States has against him. I can't believe that the grievance I have against him is simply because he's a dictator, because we've never held grudges against dictators, you see. The Spanish-American War gets a certain amount of attention because there's a heroism of Theodore Roosevelt and the Rough Riders and all of that. And I remember learning about that in school, but they never said anything about the war in the Philippines. There was something about how, as a result of the Spanish-American War, we took over the Philippines. But I never knew the details on that. But when you look into it, the Spanish-American War lasted 3 months. The Philippine War lasted for years and years. And it was a brutal, bloody suppression of the Filipino movement for independence, a war that in many ways was a precursor of the Vietnam War and the atrocities committed by the American Army in the Philippine Islands. Now that's a story, that story of the war in the Philippines that has never been told. It would not accrue to military heroism or to the glory of the United States to tell that story. To tell the story, and there were black American soldiers in the Philippines who soon began to identify more with the Filipinos than with their fellow white Americans, and who were very conscious of the fact that while they were fighting to suppress the Filipinos, these black soldiers were hearing from back home that lynchings and race riots were taking place back home in their hometowns, and black people were being killed in large numbers. And here they were fighting against colored people, against non-white people, for the United States government. And a number of black soldiers moved over and deserted and went over to fight with the Filipinos. And there was one incident when the Philippine War was supposed to be over, but really the American Army was still suppressing pockets of rebellion here and there. And in 1906, this is 6-7 years after the Army has moved into the Philippines, in 1906 there is a massacre. that's the only way to describe it, of the Moros, the Muslim inhabitants of a southern island in the Philippines, a village of 600 men, women, and children who have no arms. And the American army swoops down on them and annihilates every last one of them. Mark Twain wrote angrily about this, wrote angrily especially about the fact that President Theodore Roosevelt sent a letter of congratulations to the military commander who did this, saying this was a great military victory. This happens again and again, that when the military do heinous things, they're congratulated for great military victories. And I remember, you know, have I ever seen a movie in which Theodore Roosevelt was presented as a racist, as an imperialist, as a supporter of massacres? And there he is up on Mount Rushmore. It would take a lot to change that. I've had the idea, well, you know, a hammer, a chisel? No, it wouldn't do. War needs to be presented on film in such a way as to create a new population of people who will simply say no to war. We need to see that more and more. Need a film about the those heroic Americans who protested against World War I. They were socialists, they were pacifists, they were just people who saw the stupidity of the war that was taking the lives of 10 million people in Europe and which now the United States was entering. We look for people who can be really interesting characters in films. And you look at some of the people who at that important point during World War I opposed the war. You see Emma Goldman, the feminist anarchist who goes to prison for opposing the draft and the war. You see Helen Keller. I haven't seen Helen Keller in any film other than the kind of film that extols the fact that she was a disabled person and she became an important person. But I've never seen a film in which Helen Keller is presented as what she was, a radical, a socialist, an anti-war agitator, somebody who would refuse to cross a picket line which was set up against a play which was about her. A remarkable subject for a film. Or I think of Kate Richards O'Hare, the socialist who was put in jail for opposing World War I, and that great scene in the prison where they're stifling for lack of air, and she takes a book that she's been reading and reaches through the bars and hurls the book through the skylight above the prison corridor and lets the air in. And all the prisoners applaud and cheer because finally they're getting some fresh air. Well, I could say a lot more about possible stories and scenarios about war, about World War II. Again, a good war, right? The best of wars. But not that simple. And that's why Studs Terkel, when he did his oral history called A Good War, he put quotation marks around good war, if you notice. Because of the war, yes, humanitarian sympathies and fighting against a terrible evil, fascism, and on the other hand, a war marked by our own atrocities that multiplied as the war went on, culminating in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I have not seen a film that dealt with our bombing of Hiroshima. The closest that we come to a film which deals with our bombing of civilian population, is Kurt Vonnegut's book. The film was made about Slaughterhouse Five. But that was an oddity, a rarity. By the way, about World War I, although I have to acknowledge the rare films that were made that were anti-war, and All Quiet on the Western Front is an example of an absolutely extraordinary film. Recently, I compared, in some article I wrote about Saving Private Ryan, I compared Saving Private Ryan to All Quiet on the Western Front, about what I thought was the essential glorification of war, despite the mayhem in Saving Private Ryan, and a very absolutely diamond-clear anti-war expression of All Quiet on the Western Front. And then there are all these issues connected with class and class conflict in America and class struggle in America. And yes, we've had movies in which deal with working class people, but it's always some individual person, the working class, who rises up out of his or her situation individually and makes it in American society. But the stories of Americans who organize and get together along class lines to oppose the powers that hold them down, that has been very, very rare. You do not see films about the struggles of the textile girls, the girls who went to work in the textile mills of Massachusetts, of Lowell and Lawrence, who went in the spans a long history from the early 19th century, from the 1830s. There's a marvelous story there about the Lowell girls of the 1830s who organized and went on strike. And you will not see films about what they did, and you'll not see films about this rich history of labor struggles that took place in the United States. Because after all, the American system set up by the Constitution and the American political system and the Constitution of the United States, so revered and so celebrated, did not grant any economic rights to the American people. Did not grant we very often forget that the Constitution gives political rights but not economic rights. It gives, and even those political rights are circumscribed by the loss and the non-existence of economic rights. Because if you're not wealthy, your political rights are limited, even though they exist on paper in the Constitution. Freedom of speech is something that exists there. Yes, you have a political right of free speech, but how much free speech you have depends on how much money you have and what access to resources you have. But as far as economic rights, none of them in the Constitution. Here's the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And how can you have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness if you don't have the right to food, to housing, to health care? And so working people all through American history have had to organize and struggle, go on strike, declare boycotts, face the police and the army and the National Guard, and some of those violent and dramatic scenes. They had to do it themselves in order to win the eight-hour day, in order to somewhat change their working conditions. So I see a great film remains to be made about the railroad strikes of 1877, or about the Haymarket Affair of 1886, which was part of the struggle of the eight-hour day, which culminated in the execution of four anarchists who were charged with planting a bomb, although nobody ever found out who planted the bomb. What about the story of Eugene Debs and the great railroad strike of 1894? In which they tied up the railway system of the United States, and all the power of the army and the courts had to be brought against them. Another character from a movie, I've never seen a movie in which Eugene Debs was the central figure. I've seen all sorts of pitiful central figures in movies, but never, I mean, this magnificent person, Eugene Debs, who starts off as an organizer of railroad workers, they send him to jail, and he comes out of jail a socialist. And jail will do that to people. So they'd better be careful about how many people they send to prison. We now almost have 2 million people in prison, and if all of them did as Debs did, well.
But you're not allowed to vote once you're out, aren't you?
No, but voting wouldn't do it. Debs didn't rely on the right to vote. This really magnificent figure, when he was sent to prison for opposing World War I, and he was finally released, not by the liberal Wilson, but by the conservative Warren Harding, Debs, when he was finally released from prison, he had made such an impression on his fellow prisoners, this fantastic person, that the warden sort of let all, as he was being let out of prison and released, the warden opened up the jail cells and let everybody out into the yard. And they all applauded and shouted as Debs was being given his freedom. And then there were all these stories about, oh well. A movie needs to be made, and I met somebody last night who actually is writing a script about the Lawrence Textile Strike of 1912, a magnificent episode. Magnificent for one thing because it was one of those strikes, you know, a lot of strikes are lost. This was one. A multicultural strike of, you know, people speaking 12 different languages and would get together and defy the textile companies and defy the police and who are sent to the railroad to prevent their children from being sent away to being taken care of. Police who attack the women and children at a railroad station because they don't want the children to be sent away so that they can be taken care of because they want to starve out the strikers. But the strikers hold out, and they're helped by the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, and finally they win. And that's where, out of that comes, you know, the song Bread and Roses and the wonderful episode. And then there's the Ludlow Massacre, not far from here, the Colorado coal strike of 1913-14. Yeah, a film needs to be made of that. One of the most bitter, bloody, dramatic strikes in American history against the Rockefeller interests. Not easy to make a film against the Rockefeller interests. A film against a minor strike against the Rockefeller interests. And one of the leaders is Mother Jones, 85-year-old woman who has been organized in West Virginia and Pennsylvania, who has led children on a march from Pennsylvania to Oyster Bay, New York, to confront President Theodore Roosevelt, because these kids are working in the textile mills at the age of 11 and 12. And these kids, she marches with these kids, gets the permission of their parents, and they march all the way to New York, to where Theodore Roosevelt is having a summer vacation, you see. And they stand there with their signs, and their signs say, "We want time to play." And Mother Jones, has ever been a film made about Mother Jones? Mother Jones, 85 years old, arrested by the National Guard in Colorado, thrown into dungeons, leading the women of the strike in marches through the city of Trinidad, Colorado. And of course, there are all of those possible stories and scenarios dealing with race. And I've got to finish soon, just out of mercy.
There's the Hormel Meat Strike movie.
There's a Hormel Meat Strike movie, which, there are good movies that have been made. There are wonderful documentaries that have been made. I'm talking, of course, about what Hollywood hasn't made. No, we've never had so many wonderful documentaries. You're seeing some of them here, of course. We've never had so many wonderful documentaries as we've had, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years. Because, you know, these are documentaries which have to struggle to raise the money, and then struggle to be distributed and to be seen by people. But there are amazing successes, and I think of Michael Moore's film about, you know, Roger and me, which has been seen by tens of millions of people. Remarkable. And so, I mean, the possibilities exist to play a kind of guerrilla warfare with the system and make films and show films outside of the Hollywood establishment. Sure, sometimes you might sneak something in there. And so you always try and see if you can make them forget for a moment who they are and what they stand for. I think I, you know, David, you know, mentioned the Columbus story. We've had films on Columbus, but I don't know of any film which shows Columbus as what he was, as moved by the capitalist ethic. I mean, is Hollywood going to make a film which puts down the capitalist ethic of killing people for gold, which is what Columbus and the other Spaniards were doing? A great film could be made. And one of the figures in it could be Bartolomé de las Casas, who exposed what Columbus did in volumes, and he was an eyewitness to what was going on. And there would be this scene of this great debate that took place in 1650 in Spain between Las Casas and Sepúlveda, another priest who argued that the Indians were not human, and therefore you could do to them anything you wanted to do. Remarkable debate that took place before the Royal Commission of Spain. And of course, the story of Indian removal of the Cherokees in the southeast, of the Trail of Tears. Andrew Jackson, one of our national heroes, I remember learning in school, was a Democrat, large D, small D, middle D, Andrew Jackson was, you see. And I didn't learn then that he was a racist, that he, an Indian killer, that he signed the order to expel the Indians from the southeast part of the United States to across the Mississippi, to take them out of their lands. That was ethnic cleansing on a very large scale. I mean, the whole expulsion, the march of the American armies across the continent, and the driving of the Indians from their lands, and then finally into a little space in Oklahoma, which is called Indian Territory, and then invading Indian territory, which is supposed to be their refuge when oil was discovered there. It was no longer to be called Indian territory. I mean, this was really ethnic cleansing. But no movie that gave the story of the Cherokees, of the Trail of Tears, of going westward, where of the 16,000 people marching westward, 4,000 died. On this march, with the American army pushing them and the American presidents extolling what had happened. And then, of course, the stories of black people in the United States finally told from the black people's point of view. And, you know, we've had a number of films about the civil rights movement in which you tell the story of the Montgomery bus boycott from Sissy Spacek's point of view. You tell the story of the murder of the three civil rights workers in Mississippi in 1964 from the standpoint of the FBI, you know, who are the heroes of this film. When every person who was in Mississippi in 1964, and my wife and I were both there at the time, everybody knew that the FBI was the enemy. The FBI was watching people being beaten and not doing anything about it. The FBI was silent and not present when people needed protection against murder. And then they become, in this Hollywood film, the heroes of the film. So, yeah, we need the story of the civil rights movement told from the standpoint of black people, and the story of Mississippi told from the standpoint of Fannie Lou Hamer. We have to stop at noon, right? Am I right? Is there a boss here? Is there somebody that I am subservient to and must obey? Was there a time for a populist rebellion? What? Do we quit at noon? Oh, anyway, okay. Yeah. Well, don't encourage me. Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to say just one little thing about the Civil War, because the Civil War is again, one of our good wars. And yes, and slaves were freed as in the course of it as a result of the Civil War. But that also is not that simple. You know, there's the class element of who is drafted and who is not drafted and who makes huge amounts of money out of the Civil War and the paying of substitutes. And then there's what happens to Indians during the Civil War. You know, and I don't think you have seen, when you've seen these documentaries on the Civil War, what you've seen mostly are battle scenes. And you see Gettysburg and Antietam and Fredericksburg and Bull Run. And that's what the Civil War, and when you run into somebody, as I often do, say, oh, you're a historian. I am very interested in the Civil War. And proceeds to tell you about the Battle of Fredericksburg. You know. And that's what we see, you know, that's what the Civil War is there are the battles and there's the black people being freed. But there's another angle to it, just an element to it, which at least complicates the picture. And that is in the midst of the Civil War, while the Union armies are fighting in the South, there's another part of the Union armies which is out west destroying Indian settlements and taking over Indian land. In 1964, not long after the Emancipation Proclamation, the American Army is out in Colorado attacking an Indian village, killing hundreds of men, women, and children at Sand Creek, Colorado, one of the great Indian massacres of so many in American history, and this during, you know, the war for freedom. In the years of the Civil War, more land was taken away from the Indians than in any other comparable period in American history. So there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of historical work to be done, if such films reach the public about war and about class conflict and about who controls what in the country and about the history of governmental lives, the history of broken treaties, the history of official violence. If those stories were told, we might really produce, really bring up a new generation. Because that's, I assume, as a teacher, as a writer, I mean, that's what I'm interested in, you know. I'm not interested in just producing books, and when I was teaching, I'm not interested in just reproducing in class after class people who will get out and become successful and take their obedient places in the slots that society has prepared for them. Because I always wanted, I thought, because I thought that what all of us must be involved in, whether we teach and write, make films, direct films, play music, act, whatever we do in the culture, in the arts, has to not only make people feel good and inspire people and make people feel at one with other people around them, but it has to educate a new generation to do this sort of very modest thing, you know, to change the world. Thank you.